Let's turn to Psalm chapter 18 this morning. Psalm chapter 18. Very long psalm, and we will not finish it today. I do want to set it in context. Last week, we discovered that Jesus is the perfect embodiment of the suffering described in Psalm 22. Jesus cried the first verse of the psalm from his cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? The connections to his crucifixion in Psalm 22 were numerous and explicit, including casting lots for his garments and piercing his hands and feet. But what about Psalm 18? Jesus, in his incarnation, is the embodiment of suffering in Psalm 22. Is Jesus also the embodiment of kingship in Psalm 18? Well, let's read the psalm together. I will make minimal comments. The first three verses recognize Yahweh as David's great deliverer. I love you, O Lord, my strength. Yahweh is my rock and my fortress and my deliverer, my God, my rock, in whom I take refuge, my shield, and the horn of my salvation, my stronghold. I call upon Yahweh, who is worthy to be praised, and I am saved from my enemies. That term love in verse 1 expresses David's fierce love for God who delivered him repeatedly. Now, in verses 4 through 6, David metaphorically describes his affliction. The cords of death encompassed me. The torrents of destruction assailed me. The cords of Sheol entangled me. The snares of death confronted me. In my distress, I called upon the Lord, or Yahweh. To my God, I cried for help. From his temple, he heard my voice, and my cry to him reached his ears. David obviously feels like he's being dragged down into the grave, but his cries always reach the ears of Yahweh. So verses 7 through 15 vividly describe Yahweh moving heaven and earth to come to David's rescue. Then the earth reeled and rocked. The foundations also, the mountains trembled and quaked because he was angry. Smoke went up from his nostrils and devouring fire from his mouth. Glowing coals flamed forth from him. He bowed the heavens and came down. Thick darkness was under his feet. He rode on a cherub and flew. He came swiftly on the wings of the wind. He made darknesses covering his canopy around him, thick clouds, dark with water. Out of the brightness before him, hailstones and coals of fire broke through his clouds. Yahweh also thundered in the heavens, and the Most High uttered his voice. Hailstones and coals of fire. And he sent out his arrows and scattered them. He flashed forth lightnings and routed them. And the channels of the sea were seen. And the foundations of the world were laid bare at your rebuke, O Yahweh, at the blast of the breath of your nostrils. Is that something of God who comes to rescue? When Yahweh comes in fury to deliver his children, the result is found in verses 16 through 19. David's rescue. He sent from on high. He took me. He drew me out of many waters. He rescued me from my strong enemy and from those who hated me. For they were too mighty for me. They confronted me in the day of my calamity, but the Lord was my support. He brought me out into a broad place. He rescued me because he delighted in me. Now, verses 20 through 29 describe the relationship between the one who is rescued and the rescuer. And notice how in verses 20 through 24, David acknowledges his own faithfulness as the basis for God's rescue. The Lord dealt with me according to my righteousness. According to the cleanness of my hands, he rewarded me. For I have kept the ways of the Lord, and have not wickedly departed from my God. For all his rules were before me, and his statutes I did not put away from me. I was blameless before him, and I kept myself from my guilt. So Yahweh has rewarded me according to my righteousness, according to the cleanness of my hands in his sight. Question: do you hesitate to fully apply those words to David? Comparatively speaking, David was far more righteous than his enemies, than Saul, at least on many occasions. However, is David the perfect embodiment of these verses? Would you describe David as blameless? Might the psalm gesture beyond David? Now notice God's response to the faithful in verses 25 through 29. With the merciful, you show yourself merciful. With the blameless man, you show yourself blameless. With the purified, you show yourself pure. And with the crooked, you make yourself seem tortuous. For you save a humble people, but the haughty eyes you bring down. For it is you who light my lamp. The Lord my God lightens my darkness. For by you I can run against the truth, and by my God I can leap over a wall. God delights in delivering his people, and God gives power to the humble to overcome. And David now suddenly launches into a triumphant celebration of his perfect, delivering God. Let's read all the way down to verse 42. This God, his way is perfect. The word of the Lord proves true. He is the shield for all those who take refuge in him. And who is God but the Lord? And who is a rock except our God? The God who equipped me with strength and made my way blameless. He made my feet like the feet of a deer and set me secure on the heights. He trains my hands for war so that my arms can bend a bow of bronze. You have given me the shield of your salvation, and your right hand supported me, and your gentleness made me great. You gave a wide place for my steps under me, and my feet did not slip. I pursued my enemies and overtook them, and did not turn back till they were consumed. I thrust them through so that they were not able to rise. They fell under my feet. For you equipped me with strength for the battle. You made those who rise against me sink under me. You made my enemies turn their backs to me, and those who hated me I destroyed. They cried for help, but there was none to save. They cried to Yahweh, but he did not answer them. I made them fine as dust before the wind. I cast them out like the mire of the streets. You delivered me from strife with the people. You made me the head of the nation. People whom I had not known served me. As soon as they heard of me, they obeyed me. Foreigners came cringing to me. Foreigners lost heart and came trembling out of their fortresses. But Yahweh proves mighty in battle as David the Lord. David was Israel's greatest warrior king, and he defeated Israel's surrounding enemies and left a peaceful kingdom to his son Solomon. But is the foregoing section merely a description of David? Is there a greater conquering king yet to come? David's reference to being blameless in verse 32, like verse 23, gives us promise. Was David blameless when his troops went out to battle and he stayed home and spied Bathsheba on his side? Verse 43, was David ever the head of the nation? On verses 46 to 48, David summarizes all that he has said thus far, describing Yahweh as his rock. Yahweh lives, and blessed be my rock. Exalted be the God of my salvation, the God who gave me vengeance and subdued peoples under me, who rescued or delivered me from my enemies. Yes, you exalted me above those who rose against me. You rescued me from the man of violence. And that is an apt description of many, many periods in David's life. And now notice the final two verses. For this, I will praise you, O Yahweh, among the nations, and sing to your name. Great salvation he brings to his king, and show steadfast love to his anointed, to David and his offspring forever. Now, does Psalm 18, like Psalm 22, become embodied in Jesus Christ? At first glance, it doesn't feel quite as messianic. Whereas the first verse of Psalm 22 alerted us to its messianic overtones, that's really not the case here in Psalm 18. The hints in Psalm 18 were much more subtle. In fact, it really isn't until you get to the final two verses that we know that the psalm is truly messianic. And even there, it's not quite so clear as it is in Psalm 22. But we know this because of how Paul used the psalm in Romans chapter 15. Paul, in Romans 15, quotes verse 49 as being fulfilled in Christ's mission to save the Gentiles, not merely the Jews. Paul connects two Old Testament themes. Jesus is both the Christ, the Messiah, and the suffering servant. Paul says, "For I tell you that Christ, that's Messiah, became a servant to the circumcised to show God's truthfulness in order to confirm the promises given to the patriarchs, and this is why the Christ became a servant, and in order that the Gentiles might glorify God for his mercy." Paul says the king, the Christ, became a servant to rescue Jews and Gentiles. Well, how do we know? Well, Paul continues by quoting Psalm 18, verse 49. Paul writes, "As it is written, therefore I will praise you among the Gentiles and sing to your name." Paul's interpretation of the nations of verse 49 is that these are the Gentiles who are rescued by the Messianic servant. So Paul's use of Psalm 18 clues us in that this psalm actually points well beyond David. It points to Jesus Christ himself. So with that clue, you have to read verse 50 in a messianic light. In verse 50, a singular king brings in great salvation forever. When it says great salvation he brings to his king, the idea there is that the great gift of salvation is entrusted to who? To a king. And as he puts it, he gives great salvation to his king. The gift of salvation belongs to the king. So, was David entrusted with the great gift of salvation, Jews and Gentiles? Or was this David's distant son? John Calvin writes, "David therefore commends his seed to us, which fully applies neither to Solomon nor to any other of his successors, but to the only begotten Son of God. We shall then only duly profit in the study of this psalm when we are led by the contemplation of the shadow and type for him who is the Just as Jesus, in his incarnation, became the embodiment of the suffering servant, so Jesus becomes the embodiment of God's true Messiah. Jesus is the Colossus who cast a long shadow right on the pages of the entire Old Testament. Remember, Jesus is the Telos. He is the goal of all Old Testament revelation. He is the new Adam. He is the new Moses. He is the new David. Jesus is the Lamb, the temple, the Passover, the new Exodus. Jesus is the greater prophet, the suffering servant, the very embodiment of the Old Testament law. The whole Old Covenant prepares us to recognize God incarnate in the New Testament. Friends, David was not the perfect embodiment of the Messiah. Consequently, Yahweh entered into a covenant with David and his descendants until the true Messiah appeared. So with that general orientation in place, what I want to do this morning is actually zoom way out of this context, way out of Psalm 18, and give you a much broader historical context. And we'll come back to Psalm next week. But before zooming out, would you notice a single statement in verse 22? For all his rules were before me, and his statutes I did not put away from me. The king complies with all of God's rules, all of God's statutes. Now, was that David? Well, let's turn back to Deuteronomy chapter 17. Deuteronomy chapter 17. I commented on this passage on a Wednesday night in our series on the covenants. So I'll just limb a few important details here. When God delivered his people from slavery in Egypt, he entered into a covenant with them at Sinai. And that covenant, contrary to what many people have claimed, actually anticipated a coming monarchy. Deuteronomy 17 explains certain conditions and circumstances related to the king. In Deuteronomy 17, verse 15, Yahweh says, "You may indeed set a king over you whom Yahweh your God will choose," manifest God's part. "One from among your brothers you shall set as king over you. And that king cannot be a foreigner," keep reading, "you may not put a foreigner over you who is not your brother." And here are several additional stipulations directed at the king. Verse 16, "Only he must not acquire many horses for himself, or cause the people to return to Egypt in order to acquire many horses, since the Lord has said to you, you shall never return that way again. And he shall not acquire many wives for himself, lest his heart turn away, nor shall he acquire for himself excessive silver and gold." Yahweh's ideal king is not interested in acquiring a fortune or building a great army with many, many horses. Horses in the ancient world were essential to a great army, and that was especially true of Egyptian horses. They were bred and trained for pulling chariots in the battle. Further, God's ideal king is not a polygamist like so many ancient Near Eastern monarchs. Clearly, David fell short of these standards. He was a man of war, and he did acquire wealth, and his multiple wives proved problematic. And Solomon was considerably worse. He was history's most notorious polygamist. Solomon acquired excessive silver and gold. The First Kings records not only Solomon's import of horses from Egypt, but his excessive spending on riders and chariots. Look at these words. "And Solomon gathered together chariots and horsemen. He had 1,400 chariots and 12,000 horsemen, And we stationed the chariot cities and with the king in Jerusalem. And the king made silver as common in Jerusalem as stone. And he made cedar as plentiful as the sycamore of the Shephelah. And Solomon's import of horses was from Egypt and Kew. And the king's traders received them from Kew at a price. A chariot could be imported from Egypt for 600 shekels of silver and a horse for 150. And if that weren't enough, Solomon entered into a formal marriage alliance with Pharaoh. All of that, the narrator goes on to tell us in 1 Kings 11, proved to be Solomon's undoing. And he turned his heart away from God. David fell short of the ideal Messiah. And his son and successor was a disaster. He gave his heart to many women, to money, to horses, to armies, and the kingdom after him split apart. And Rehoboam, David's grandson, and his further descendants never proved to be ideal Messiah. Now keep reading, and notice a further requirement of the king. And when he sits, verse 18, and when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, he shall write for himself in a book a copy of this law approved by the Levitical priest. The king, Yahweh declares, must procure an official copy of the law. If you recall from King Josiah's time, that practice was all but lost. It was all but lost until a dusty copy turned up during the temple repair. Now observe what the king must do with that official copy. Verse 19, and it shall be with him. And he shall read in it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear Yahweh his God by keeping all the words of his law and his statutes and doing them, that his heart may not be lifted up above his brothers, and that he may not turn aside from the commandment, either to the right hand or to the left, so that he may continue long in his kingdom, he and his children in Israel. Friends, was David the embodiment of God's expectations for the ideal king? Well, certainly David tried on many occasions to keep God's law. Certainly God promised longevity would come to his kingdom. And David himself told us in Psalm 18:22, remember the text, for all his rules are before me, and the statutes I did not put away from thee. And that sounds like David tried to follow this passage, like get the law and keep it before me at all times. And compared to Saul, David was in fact a much greater embodiment of these verses. Nevertheless, does anyone want to claim, well, David perfectly embodied Deuteronomy chapter 17? Is Psalm 18:22 a description merely of David's attempt insofar as it was humanly possible to keep God's command? Or should we just go right on searching for the perfect embodiment of God's requirement for the true Messiah? Put another way, can you see Jesus Christ in verses 19 and 20? Do you suspect that Jesus lived by God's law all the days of his life? Look at verse 19 and consider Jesus' response to Satan. Man shall not live by bread alone, but every word that comes from the mouth of God. Jesus said in Matthew 5, he did not come to eviscerate a single jot or tittle of the law, but to fulfill it all. Well, isn't that verse 20? When I read Deuteronomy 17, I don't see Saul. I don't see David. I don't see Saul. But I don't see any king of Israel or Judah, despite valiant attempts on the part of some to keep this passage. When I read Deuteronomy 17, I just have to keep working right down the line to Matthew's genealogy until I finally come to a man named Jesus. Emmanuel, God with us. Now, would you fast forward to the dark days of the Judges, Judges chapter 21. Judges chapter 21. Do you recall the repeated refrain at the end of Judges? The land of Israel descended into paganism, anarchy, civil war, idolatry, and immorality. And the end of Judges is an absolute catastrophe, gruesome and grotesque. A tale of idolatry, immorality, sexual abuse, and hacking a woman's body in 12 pieces and delivering it to the 12 tribes. And there is a repeated line that clues you into the disaster. It's also the final word of Judges. Notice verse 25. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Certainly no ideal king like Deuteronomy 17. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And here is the theme of Judges. A disobedient people need a truly righteous king. Now turn to Ruth chapter 4. After Judges, the book of Ruth takes us on a curious little detour through Moab, introducing a Gentile matriarch into the Messianic line. And Ruth ends with a really curious genealogy linking the Messianic line to a man named Perez. Look at verse 18. Now these are the generations of Perez. The genealogy runs from Perez to David. Well, who is this Perez? I can understand going back to Israel, father of the 12 tribes, or especially to Abraham. Why begin a genealogy with an obscure figure named Perez? Well, back in Jacob's day, when Jacob blessed his son Judah, he made a startling and cryptic prophecy. He said in Genesis 49 and verse 10, the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet until tribute comes to him. And to him shall be the obedience of the people. The scepter of the kingdom belongs to the line of Judah. However, when you read that prophecy, it's clear the true ruler who wields that scepter and secures the obedience of the people, well, he's going to be somewhere down the line. Don't expect that ruler to appear anytime too soon. In fact, Judah himself had already sired an illegitimate son through an incestuous relationship with his Gentile daughter-in-law named Tamar, who played the harlot. That whole disgusting story is found in Genesis chapter 38, and it sounds like it belongs at the end of Judges on a supermarket tabloid. So who is this son of Judah who launches the royal line carrying the scepter down to the Messiah? You know his name? Perez, the illegitimate son born of prostitution and incest. Ruth's genealogy picks up the messianic line from Perez to David. Oh, wouldn't you rather forget the story of Perez? There are, in fact, deliberate gaps in the genealogy. Well, why not leave that one out? Clearly, not only were David's descendants compromised, so were his ancestors. In Matthew's genealogy of Jesus, the evangelist does not hesitate to name not only Tamar and Ruth, but he adds Gentiles of dubious reputation, Rahab and Bathsheba, along with a whole line of rather treacherous kings. Maybe the ideal king isn't quite the king any of us were expecting. We've already discovered in Psalm 22, he is the perfect embodiment of human suffering. But Isaiah 53 adds this, that one who suffers, he
is numbered with transgressors. And if you want to see that illustrated, look at Jesus' genealogy. There's a whole lot of transgressors in that. After Ruth, we come to 1 and 2 Samuel. Originally, they were one book. So let's think of them as one book this morning. And let's turn to nearly the end, 2 Samuel 23. Now, I wrote this sermon like 6 months ago, and I had no idea Joseph was going to read 2 Samuel 23 this morning. This is all God's providence. All right? 2 Samuel 23. And remember, the theme of Judges is this: a disobedient people need a truly righteous king. And Samuel introduces us to Israel's united monarchy. And Samuel, just a second, Samuel is the story of two kings, Saul and David. Now, is one of these the ideal king? That's the question we have to ask. When the book opens, the corruption of the priesthood, Eli and his sons, is paralleled by the corruption of Samuel's own sons, which provoked Israel to seek a king. And God acquiesces and appoints Saul, outwardly speaking, an ideal human choice. However, Saul unlawfully attempts to offer sacrifice as a priest king and forfeits the kingdom. Unlike Saul, David was a man of God's own choosing. I've explained this previously. David was a man whom God chose after God's own heart. It was God's choice. But David, likewise, cannot be a true priest king or even build a temple. When God enters into a covenant with David, it's clear from the beginning the covenant ultimately concerns some future descendant of David. Now, the most striking difference between David and Saul is this: David is a repentant king. But a repentant king is obviously an imperfect king. And the ending of Samuel communicates this truth. The ending of Samuel is perhaps, I think it is, the most curious ending of any Old You literary experts, Samuel's ending communicates some extraordinarily significant truths. And Samuel's ending will really help us interpret Psalm 18. Would you look at Samuel 23, verse 1? Now, these are the last words of David. David has come to the end of his life. It's time for his final words. And then glance down at verse 8, where we have a list of David's great warriors. These are the names of the mighty men whom David had. And I won't be as great as David and read all these names. All right? But when you read that passage, it reads like a triumphant epilogue on David's life. Does it not? It's a grand, triumphant rehearsal of the great heroes of Israel's age of empires and legends. It reads like Tolkien's description of the ancient glory of the kings of Middle-earth, or King Arthur's legendary Knights of the Round Table. The passage reads like the chronicles of other Near Eastern monarchs. The king speaks his final words, and he's laid to rest in the hallowed halls of military history. That's how the passage reads. That's the end, right? Wrong. Samuel never records David's death. Isn't that odd? David doesn't die until we get to the second chapter of the next book. And curiously, there's another chapter in 2 Samuel. And that final chapter leaves us bitterly disappointed with David. It's difficult to say where it even fits in with David's life chronologically, but certainly it is out of place chronologically. That's what I'm thinking. It must have happened before David spoke his final words.
And if you'll simply notice a section heading above chapter 24 in the ESV, it reads, David's census. And look at verse 10. But David's heart struck him after he had numbered the people. Remember Deuteronomy 17? You're not supposed to take pride in your army. David's heart struck him after he had numbered the people. And David said to the Lord, I have sinned greatly in what I have done. How would he have known that? Because he's reading God's law, Deuteronomy 17, right? But now, O Lord, please take away the iniquity of your servant, for I have done very foolishly. Samuel's final word on David is he sinned greatly, foolishly. Now, unlike Saul, David is repentant. That is crucial. But clearly, David is not the ideal king. And Yahweh's judgment fell on David and his kingdom. Verse 15 tells of a terrible pestilence that took away, look at this, 70,000. Of course, they're all sinful people. I'm not going to go into the question here. So be the fault. They're all guilty, of course. But 70,000. This plague burned right the nation, right up to the threshing floor of Arunah the Jebusite, a plot of ground later used to build the temple. And on the spot, David built an altar, and the last line of Samuel reads, so the Lord responded to the plea of the land, and the plague was abated for Israel. But there are 70,000 casualties. When David struck down Goliath, the women went out singing, Saul has struck down his thousands and David his tens of thousands. Yes, David again has struck down his tens of thousands of his own people. That is the bitter end of our tale of two kings. So what is Samuel's final assessment of David? David is an imperfect Messiah. He is an imperfect king. He is an imperfect deliverer of his people. Now a judge is left as looking for a truly righteous king. And here we are at the end of 2 Samuel, and we're still looking. Is David the perfect embodiment of Yahweh's ideal Messiah? Clearly not. Remember how Psalm 18 ended? Even the Gentile nations will come and claim great salvation that Yahweh brings to his king, to his anointed. But Samuel's final word is the great King David brought death. Now, why did I take the time to work through all that history? How does it relate to Psalm 18? And the answer is very simple. Let's not turn to Psalm 18. Let's turn back to 2 Samuel 22. Just two chapters back. And would you look at verse 1? And David spoke to the Lord the words of this song on the day when the Lord delivered him from the hand of all his enemies, and from the hand of Saul. Well, do you recognize that language? That was the language that was at the head of Psalm 18. And now glance down to the whole chapter. Do you recognize the psalm? It's Psalm 18. The same psalm shows up twice in the Bible. Isn't that interesting? And now notice verses 50 to 51. For this, I will praise you, O Lord, among the nations, and sing praises forever, and sing praises to your name. Great salvation he brings to his king, and shows steadfast love to his anointed, to David and his offspring forever. God has a great king who brings in salvation to the nations. Well, friends, is this David? Well, if chapter 23 was the final chapter, we might just wonder. The chapter gives us a beautiful recording of David's final words, followed by an account of the mighty deeds of his great warriors. unless we think that David was the embodiment of the ideal Messiah, then just read the final chapter. Yes, David is slaying of tens of thousands, 70,000 of his own people who lay dead and dying. Great salvation does not come through David. We need a new Messiah who can truly embody the words of verses 22-25, which is the text. For I have kept the ways of the Lord, and have not wickedly departed from my God. For all his rules are before me, and from his statutes I did not turn aside. I was blameless before him, and I kept myself from guilt. And the Lord has rewarded me according to my righteousness, according to my cleanness in his sight. Friends, those words represent the true embodiment of Deuteronomy 17. And those words were truly embodied not by David, but by Christ and Christ alone. Jesus becomes the full embodiment of God's ideal Messiah, just as Jesus is the embodiment of the suffering servant and sufferer of Psalm 22. This is again why John Calvin wrote, David, therefore, commends his seed to us, which fully applies to either Solomon or to any of his successors, but to the only begotten Son of God. And if David were here this morning, here's what he would say. Friends, look to Jesus. So we say, Father, we're thankful for the great salvation that has come, not through any ordinary man, but through God incarnate, through Jesus Christ, descended through a long line of wretched sinners like the rest of us, the virgin born. He lived a perfect life. He kept your law before him at all times. He perfectly embodied your ideal. The man who kept every jot, every tittle of your law. And we confess him as the suffering servant. And we confess him as our great king. And even as we sang this morning, we confess him to be the lion. And we confess him to be the lion.